We're on the air. Yeah. Is this the Free the Land show on May 29th, 2012? The end of the world year? Well, this is that.
Yes, it is.
This is the Free the Land show. Coral is at the control boards. We have Dennis Etler here tonight, a Marxist, teaches physical anthropology at Cabrillo College, and also is he founded the secular humanist organization in town. That means you're an atheist.
Most assuredly, huh?
Okay, that's a valid belief in God, non-belief in God. God both exists and doesn't exist in my cosmology. We're going to talk about Marxism. He's also a regular at Occupy. Talk about the difference between anarchism and Marxism. What is the main difference between the two?
When you're talking about Marxism, I mean, it's such a broad topic, but if you're politically speaking,
the differences, the technical.
Yeah, I mean, I think you got to look at it, you know, from a political vantage point. I mean, Marxists are interested in organizing the whole society into some sort of formation where it serves human needs rather than, you know, individual greed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, you know, that basic underlying ideology of anarchism and Marxism are very similar.
Yeah,
they're both anti-capitalist. But the thing is, how are you going to organize a country of 300 million, you know, based on the, you know, the level of productivity that has been established and, you know, so that, you know, the goods are distributed in an equitable fashion, you know, wealth is equitably distributed. And that people have, you know, both, you know, social, political, and economic democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a large scale endeavor. It's something that requires organization. Anarchy is
get a 300 million consensus.
Yeah, well, anarchy is very good, and you know, on a small scale, collective, you know, sort of level. And yeah, you might be able to build up from, you know, from the bottom up, you know, to, you know, scale it up.
But
that doesn't really fit in, as you say, into the, you know, anarchist sort of mindset. So it's just, you know, it's sort of an idealistic, you know, construct. And it's all well and good, but it only can, you know, function on a small scale, you know, amongst the, you know, like-minded people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not going to be anything that's going to be able to organize the large-scale society.
So we saw with Occupy, I mean, went off to a good start, but now it's kind of petering out. Can't hear us? How are the levels? Punch the mics up a little more. The mics are way down. What are you doing? You should be up at the top.
Go ahead.
So this mic isn't working?
Keep going.
All right.
Just talk loud.
So we were talking about the difference. They started around the same time, right, with the Industrial Age.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a response to capitalism and industrial capitalism and finance capitalism that, you know, developed as a result thereof. So they're responding to the very same sort of alienation that sets in with capitalist, large-scale capitalist production.
They both were strong in the unions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have the anarcho-syndicalist movement. You know, you have the, you know, the various, you know, socialist workers' movements, you know, throughout the latter portion of the 19th century. And they were, you know, basically more or less in sync with one another. I mean, look at the Wobblies, you know. They're mm-hmm. basically an anarchistically minded, you know, group. But from amongst the Wobblies, you got, you know, some of the, you know, founders of the Communist Party USA, you know, came from the Wobblies. So, you know, it's not as if they were in direct contradiction. Generally speaking, you know, the anarchists, communists, socialists, you know, they could unite in their fight against capitalism and fascism.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the Spanish Civil War, you know, they were united, but they eventually have a falling out, you know, because their programs are, you know, just eventually come in conflict. You know, as you say, you know, the communist movement is, you know, thinking on you know, large-scale hierarchical structures. Anarchists are thinking small-scale, you know, sort of collectivist ideas that, you know, don't take well to, you know, that level of organization. So eventually they come into conflict.
And they didn't use consensus back then either, the anarchists or the communists. It was a majority. They both used committees, though. Right?
Yeah, I mean, look at the Soviets. The Soviets, when first organized, you know, on the shop floor, you know, in Russia, was pretty much not so dissimilar to the Occupy movement, like a general assembly. I mean, that's all the Soviet was a general assembly of workers in the workplace. And in other sorts of collective situations, you know, in on the campus, in the workplace, you know, that's all that a Soviet was. Basically, it's Russian for a general assembly. You know,
I noticed that a lot of movements, it's the students and the unions get together, and that provides a revolutionary kind of environment. And then when you pull some of the military over, then you can win. And that's what hasn't happened yet in Egypt. The military is still firmly in the hands of...
That's a very complex situation in Egypt because you have so many desperate, you know, factions and forces, you know, contending with one another. And, the army came out of the nationalist movement, you know, under Nasser back in the 50s, which was a revolutionary movement. I mean, the thing is, it basically turned and became, you know, a satrap of the neoliberal, you know, ideology.
Power will corrupt you.
Yeah, well, you know, it's... it's really, you know, it's complex. I mean, these forces mutate into, you know, their opposite on more than one occasion.
I saw that happening at Occupy, too. Now, you've lived in China, too, so you've seen change from full socialist communist to part capitalist with control.
I spent a considerable amount of time in China. You know, lived there for lengths of time, basically from the mid-80s through to, you know, the end of the century, around 1996, 97. But I've been back a few times since. But that 15-year period, I was conducting doctoral research in China and had the opportunity to really travel throughout the country into areas that were basically not all that open to foreigners, because I was doing archaeological field work, and, you know, I was being accompanied by Chinese archaeologists to sites and locations well off the beaten track, you know, where basically Westerners had never been to or hadn't been for decades.
So are those areas different than, say, Beijing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, China's just...
Politically,
it was in the rural areas, it was just a very different type of, situation than you'd find in the cities. But I spent a lot of time in Beijing and in Wuhan, which is a big industrial city, sort of like the Chicago of China.
Now, did they pay rent in both places?
Well, now, when I first went to China in the early 80s, what's known as the Iron Rice Bowl policy was still in effect. That was basically the socialist policy that had been established under Mao when the PRC, the People's Republic, was founded in 1949. And basically for the urban working class, you know, those who worked in state-owned enterprises, and virtually all the factories and large-scale enterprises are state-owned at that time, they had basically a campus. The factory was... It was like a factory town.
So they didn't pay rent?
They didn't pay... Well, they minimal rent. you know, virtually everything was supplied. You know, food was subsidized, and that the staple food items were basically given away close to free. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you could buy whatever was available on the open market, so it's a supplement what was given. So you had a base, you know, you had a secure, you know, a base of staple food items.
A survival part, and then
So you had rice, you had, you know, whatever, right. You know.
Now, how's that compared to those areas you talk about that very few people saw?
Okay, now out in the rural areas, the commune system had long since, you know, been transformed. It basically was no longer in existence. And they had a new policy, which basically allowed the farmers to lease land on a long-term basis. So it was basically called the responsibility system. And each farm family, you know, had a few, you know, hectares or whatever available for them to farm individually.
How long were the leases?
99 years.
Was this to the family or an individual?
To the family, because those leases could be renewed.
Passed on.
Yeah, passed on to the offspring.
And the rent stayed the same the whole 99 years?
Well, there was no rent. You know, no rent. The land is held in common by the nation.
Do they have to give a portion of their
crop? Well, there would be tax. Yeah, okay. There would be tax. And, so much in China harkens back to the way it was done traditionally. I mean, right. There was always an agricultural tax levied on the farmers by the central authorities or the local authorities. And, you know, so, you know, that was, you know, instituted under this new regime, the responsibility system.
So if they had a bad crop, they wouldn't have to pay tax that year?
Okay, now there, when you get down to those particulars, I can't really say one way or another, but, I mean, it was nothing like in the old days, you know. Now, there were protests at times when the taxes were thought to be too onerous, and basically, you know...
was this, in the 80s?
In the 80s and 90s, but, you know, eventually that got sorted out, because the government was... You know, responsive.
They're making more money off manufacturing.
Yeah, and they're responsive. They don't want to see unrest. See, the
right.
thing about
the
way things operate in China is that they're very concerned about consensus. You know, their idea of consensus is a little bit different. Their idea of consensus is, you know, sort of the middle way, you know, create a harmonious society,
right, exactly.
And all of that. So the central government, you know, they want to placate the masses, basically. So, I mean, like last year, there were like 90,000 strikes, you know, throughout China, and these are all mediated. They send in work teams, and you know, and basically they settle whatever disputes there are in some sort of equitable fashion, where, you know, basically people go away. They feel that their, you know, grievances have been redressed. I mean, you don't hear about, you know, major upheavals in China, even though there are, you know, these tens of thousands of incidents that occur.
Well, Tiananmen Square,
that's a singular instance, mm-hmm. You know. I'm talking about on an annual basis.
Oh,
there are tens of thousands of incidents that occur throughout China. Well, the Western press tries to make this out to be, you know, some sort of, you know, destabilizing, you know, situation in China, and, you know, they're thinking of the Arab Spring, and, you know, how the people are discontented. Well, but the thing is, it's a sort of like a release valve, you know.
Petition for a redress.
Yeah, because they there's obviously the ability for people to protest and demand a redress of grievances, and they're not repressed, they're not shot down in the streets.
Well, unless they have a religion, right?
If the religion, you know,
if it's small, they don't care. But if it's
if they're trying to like assert some degree of power, you know, to challenge the ruling authorities, well, no, that's not going to stand. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a clear separation of church and state in China. But, you know, you're free to practice, you know.
And they're evangelical Christians in China. You can go on the web and find stories. I mean, they pretty much have free reign. Mm-hmm. It's only when they become political, you know, that, you know, the state basically says, you know, no, go. But and when there's some, for, you know, like...
All right, so yeah. Now getting back to the land, since this is free of the land, it used to be really, really cheap. That's changing now, isn't it?
Well, that's a big problem now, particularly in some of the rural areas closer to the major cities where development's, you know, ongoing.
Want to put some more big buildings in?
Yeah, because what you have, and there's a lot of corruption in China.
No, you're kidding.
Oh, wow. I mean, the thing is...
Without capitalism?
You can't,
well, I guess they're kind of capitalist.
You can't
now,
paint China with a broad brush, you know. I mean, there's good and bad and the ugly. I mean, there's a lot of ugly in China. I've been there, I've seen it, you know. So, but there's, you know, there's lots to, you know, think about. You know, they've done amazing things in terms of raising the living standard of, you know, gosh, you know, 1/6 of the world's population. Mm-hmm. I mean...
That's living, more recent, though, right?
Within the last 30 years. But even after World War II, with the establishment of the People's Republic, there was a vast change in the livelihood of the Chinese people. I mean, it was at a pretty much a subsistence level. When I first went to China... You know, in the rural areas, you know, people were still eating corn gruel, you know, as their basic, you know, meal. You know, it was, you know, pretty poor. You know, you'd have a table and a chair and a kong. A kong is this, you know, concrete, you know, sort of bed, you know, with you put a fire underneath, you know, burning embers to warm it. And you know, quilts and, you know, and not much else. I mean, it was very, very Spartan. Totally different now. You know, you go to any rural community and, you know, it's electrified, you know, everybody has a TV antenna, mm-hmm. and, you know, they have, you know, pretty much, you know, the basic consumer durables, and everybody's built new two-story farmhouses.
Well, they're kicking our ass economically. We're getting poorer and they're getting richer.
Well, yeah. I mean, see, that's the thing about China. That people don't understand. They think it's either socialist or capitalist.
It's mixed, just like we are.
It's mixed, but in a very different sort of way, because you have, you know, the Communist Party is in power, you know. I mean, there's no question about
that. It's a one-party system.
It's a one-party system, but within the Communist Party, you have ideological factions that are almost diametrically opposed to one another. You know, much greater difference
so they
politically.
Have elections?
No, but I'm saying within the party itself, you
so
have.
So how do they choose?
Because it's in a party struggle.
But what does that mean? They knock each other off? Or?
Well, you just look at what's going on in China today. There's Bo Xiaolei, you know, the party chief in Chongqing has just been purged. You know, there's a lot of political struggle.
What does that mean? He went to jail?
Well, basically, he was deposed. He was stripped of his authority.
Now, how does that happen if the people don't vote for it?
Well, no. What we have in China is called democratic centralism, you know.
The party votes?
It's a dual track. You have the party itself, and then you have the government. They're not one and the same.
Okay.
And then you have another, you know, institution called the Political Consultative Conference, which are non-party people, you know. And
they have no power.
As it said, it's a consultative conference. I mean, but they are consulted, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if they're totally ignored and disregarded, you know, but they don't have the power like the party does, obviously, but the party is riven with factions, but they rule by consensus. So it's like a coalition government. What you have in China is really a coalition government.
So a majority among the party can kick out the minority.
Well, generally speaking, what's going on in China now is a big generational transfer of power. You know, from
to the more capitalists.
Basically age cohorts. So you're going to the fifth generation of leadership.
Are you saying the older ones are dying out?
What they instituted in China back in the 90s was like a 12-year period, you know, of generational rule. So, like the president, you know. has a 6-year term, and he can basically stay for 2 terms, and then there's a transfer of power. Now, it's not due through direct elections or anything of that sort. You know, there's
behind closed door machinations.
Well, you know, they have their People's Congress. Now, the People's Congress is a government. You know, parliament, you know, it's a unicameral government.
All right, so they get to vote there.
You know, so, yeah, the president, you know...
This communism always confuses me. Is that who knows that he's in charge of them killing each other off?
It's, like I say, it's basically a coalition government. Now, you have... you really got to get down to basics here. The thing is, in China... You have what's been called the socialist road and the capitalist road, right? Now, the socialist road was what Mao basically initiated, you know, when he was around. That's the Iron Rice Bowl, you know, the communes, you know, it's just basically...
Free stuff for everyone.
Yeah, basically, you know, command-style economy and all of that. And the capitalist road is were always in the party, at least as Mao defined them, and they were the ones who wanted to see a much more liberal, in the economic sense of the term, not in the political sense that we commonly, in the classical, you know, economic sense of the word, which refers to, you know, the utilization...
Anarcho-capitalism.
Laissez-faire
capitalism.
Well, they call it market socialism. It's using the market mechanism. Yeah. Now, you know, you laugh as if the market and socialism are in contradiction to one another. But the market is just a mechanism, a lever, you know, to spur economic growth.
The longer the line for the free stuff, the more resources are pushed toward that direction.
You know,
is that how it works?
You know, China was at a very, very low level of productivity after World War II, even lower than Russia was before the, you know, the Russian Revolution, 1917. They had been devastated by 100 years of misrule, under the Qing Dynasty, which was moribund by, you know, the 20th century, and then you had one warlord after another, and then you had, you know, the European and American colonialists, with the unequal treaties and the opium wars and all of this. And then, of course, you had the warlords, basically dismembering China into warring factions. And then you had the Japanese aggression, you had, like, the Nanjing Massacre, where, you know, like, 400,000 people were... You know, slaughtered within 2 or 3 days. You know, and it was just devastating. And then, of course, there was the Civil War immediately after the War of Aggression. You know, that's how they refer to the war.
It's hard to be productive when you're getting shot at.
And then the Kuomintang, basically, in the areas that they, that's the Nationalist Party that the Communists were, warring against. They were, known for their rampant corruption and crony capitalism. They were what are known as comprador capitalists. They were in the pay of the foreign interests.
That's how we got here.
And basically, inflation, it was hyperinflation. You know, it's like, you had to have a wheelbarrow of, of money to purchase,
That leads to civil unrest.
Yeah, so... It was a total, disaster. China was just a basket pick case.
And what year is this?
In 1948-49, before the communists take over. And,
so that made it much easier for Mao to take over.
Well, China was known as the sick man of Asia throughout the first half of the 20th century.
So Mao started with how many people in the beginning?
Well, he started with just a handful. I mean, when the Communist Party
Less
was founded,
100?
There were... Oh, there were 20-some-odd people.
20 people. Started with 20 people and took over a nation of...
Well, that was in 1921.
Yeah.
But
it took them 30 years.
Just think, 1921 to 1949. I mean, that's 28 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, subtract 28 from 2012. Can you anybody figure that out? Got your calculator around?
84.
So, just think. think if, you know, there was a, you know, some organization formed in 1984 with 20 people, and, you know, in 2012 they basically took over the entire country. I mean, and in that period,
it's kind of what,
know,
the Republicans were doing.
Well, they actually kind of did that, didn't they? Yeah, that's, well, there you go. I mean, it can be done.
Just gotta be patient.
Okay,
that's
you
all.
Occupy.
But they had a lot of money, though. I mean, it wasn't just 20
yeah,
people.
So I mean, and there was, you might have heard of the Long March and all of that. Yeah. You know, where, you know, the, you know, Mao had organized this peasant army up in the mountains of Hunan or wherever, and yeah. And you know, there were about 100.
We got lots of mountains around
100,000 you know, people that he mobilized, and then the Kuomintang, you know, the nationalists that surrounded them, sort of like the same type of policy, you know, anti-insurgency policy yeah. that we're still practicing today.
Yeah, yeah.
And but they escaped, you know, they, and then they went on this trek of like 10,000 miles through
gathering
the rural, you know, the wilds of, you know, rural China up into the Himalayas and, you know, through swamps.
They were gathering
and
people
on
the way,
and,
right?
And they ended up in Yan'an, you know, in you know, Shanxi province in northern China, with about 10,000 people out of the 100,000 who started.
You know, that's very similar to what the guy Ahmed Salih did in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
He got the idea. He went door to door to find out what people were doing, and they all said, well, I'll join when everybody else is joining. So he started out small in the narrow alleys with just a few people, but it seems like a larger group in a small alley. And as he got a few people that way, he'd go to bigger and bigger streets until he could take the square. So you start small, and then it's built.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they had, obviously, they also had the correct political line, because they were able to mobilize people. You know, they went in for land reform in the countryside, and the whole idea that Mao had
was, occupies land reform, you know,
yeah.
free
but
rent.
The whole idea that Mao had was to encircle the cities, you know. It was a peasant yeah. revolution.
Yeah, that's...
And that's what has happened in China, going back thousands of years. Whenever a dynasty, you know, is moribund and is, you know, and needs to be replaced, as a peasant rebellion. You know, yeah. the Tang Dynasty, the Ming Dynasty, you know, all the major dynasties, the Han Dynasty.
Because they end up exploding.
They were all led by, you know, peasant.
Yeah, that's who gets exploded.
Rebellions. Yeah, yeah, right.
And manufacturing is a little different, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then after you establish a new dynasty, and Mao basically established the Red Dynasty in China, for all intents.
Is that your own invention?
No. That's been said many a time. But what you do when a new dynasty is established is you mobilize the masses, you know, through corvée labor, basically. You know, you conscript, you know, the peasants.
Enslave them.
Well, if you want to refer to it. But, you know, it was done, you know, under the guise of, you know, this profound, you know, nationalism, you know, where people wanted to, you know, volunteer their labor. Really,
well,
they did.
If you're volunteering,
they
wanted, you're volunteering.
They had this spirit of, you know, wanting to reconstruct China, you know. It was a... I mean, you can imagine, you know, if your country has been devastated for, you know, 100
years.
Sure,
but why conscript that if you have...
Well, no, I'm not saying it was, you know, it's like conscription, you know. I mean, there wasn't, well, what can you say? I mean, there was a lot of...
I'm trying to get the truth here.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to be honest
people,
here,
yeah.
You know. The
you
thing
may
is,
not be able to go
there
back
would
to China
be
now,
so but. Much peer pressure... You know, to
right,
you know,
right.
to engage in this sort of, you know, mass, you know, volunteer labor, you know.
So it wasn't imposed by the government, it was peer pressure.
Well, you know, it's really irrelevant, because this is this is a pattern of Chinese history and
okay.
civilization. Every new dynasty, the same thing.
They do
the you know, they rebuild the canals, you know, they rebuild the waterworks, they, you know, they just reconstruct everything that's deteriorated. And, you know, so this has gone on, you know, for millennia in China. So basically what Mao did was what every, new emperor, you know, who basically emerged from the peasantry has always done, was, you know, there would be a, the first generation is basically to reconstruct the country, through mass mobilization. So that was the socialist road. In the countryside, it was eventually to collectivize, you know, and then communize, you know, form the people's communes.
So it worked for a while, but then something happened.
Well, it just, you know, the material conditions just weren't
enough
to sustain it. And there were some natural disasters. There was a great leap forward. And there was a lot of just, you know, crazy thinking. You know, you're dealing with basically, you know, people who had, well, totally unsophisticated. You know, they had no idea really what was needed or what happened.
Well, in the beginning, but didn't they institute education and stuff?
Well, yeah, they're doing this all, but, you know, this is in like a 10-year period, you know.
From,
you know, 1949 to 1959. Yeah, I mean, you just can't imagine the total social upheaval and dislocation and you know, the mass mobilizations. And I mean, it's a crazy, crazy period. And then there was this massive famine that occurred during the Great Leap Forward because there were logistical problems and they were trying to, you know, forge steel in backyard, you know, foundries, and it was crazy. You know, they there was just a lot of crazy thinking, you know, that just didn't reflect reality, and it led to some really dire consequences. And you know. You know, this got all played out within the party struggles and a party struggle. There were a lot of people who were dead set against all of this. They wanted a more measured approach. You know, they basically wanted to initiate the type of reforms that Deng Xiaoping initiated in the 1980s. They wanted to do that in the 50s. They wanted to basically, they basically said, look, like in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, Lenin initiated what was called the New Economic Policy, and the netmen, these were private entrepreneurs, you know, they were, you know, Lenin realized that there had to be room for, you know, private enterprise and, you know, basically capitalist relations of production. Because
on a small scale.
On not on such a small scale. In the Soviet Union, there was really, you know, sort of a renaissance of capitalist, you know, type of activity. But then, of course, in the mid-20s, after Lenin died, Stalin, you know, came into power, and he totally negated that whole, you know, idea and opted for building socialism in one country.
Command
economy and all of that. Well, in China in the 50s, there were those who realized that China was even more backward than Russia had ever been. And there needed to be a long period of what they called new democracy. This was a coalition between the peasantry, the proletariat, the working class, and the national bourgeoisie. The national bourgeoisie was seen as a very progressive force.
Did they do this?
It was called New Democracy. Well, Mao was, he was a great proponent of New Democracy, but he saw the proletariat as the leading class, and the other classes basically had to be subservient to the Communist Party,
so
as the vanguard of the working class. So, you know, they didn't have, they were eventually shunted aside.
So there was very little.
There was very little, you know, markets were basically eliminated. And,
how about Lenin's? Did Lenin's work very good?
It revitalized the Soviet economy back in the early 20s.
So basically just take the money away from the super rich right now and give it to the small-time entrepreneur, and they're going to be more creative and produce more.
Eventually
they become the new, you know,
the bourgeoisie and the party. Mao was dead set against, you know, the emergence of a new bourgeoisie in the party. But, you know,
that's happening now.
That's happening now, yeah. But see, so there's this constant struggle between what's called the socialist road and the capitalist road. Now, some would say, well, the capitalist road is won out, you know, after, you know, Mao died and the Gang of Four were eliminated and Deng got back into power. And then, you know, but see, there's this constant struggle between, under socialism, you know, socialism, there's still class struggle. There's still, you know, struggle between the socialist and the capitalist road. And even though maybe there is a capitalist road that's being implemented, even if, you know, that policy is in the driver's seat, doesn't mean that, you know, the class struggle has ended. So, you know, there's still struggle within the party, the struggle outside the party. I mean, it's a very, you know, socialism.
People are still greedy.
People are still greedy, so they're still corrupt. Mm-hmm. And the working class, you know, has seen many of the gains that it made under the socialist road, under the Iron Rice Bowl, you know,
disappear.
But then again, the capitalist road as implemented in China has, you know, led to the vast expansion of the means of production.
Mm-hmm. And they're much wealthier now.
The raising of living standards for everyone. Now, there's a lot of income disparity in China. It's sort of like the trickle-down idea, you know, that we see here. But it has worked to a much greater extent in China in that it's raised, you know, everybody's living standards. But, you know, in some instances, you know, living standards have deteriorated. Now, for those members of the working class who had basically, subsidies, you know, and, you know, they had educational benefits, they had healthcare benefits, basically they had a secure life.
They're getting
screwed. And the thing is, now they don't have those benefits as they once did. But they make more money.
Some of them.
Everybody to a certain extent, you know, some more than others. And, I mean, the market, you know, you go to China today and there's everything imaginable to buy. You know, it's not like, you know, like people have images of the Soviet Union where, you know,
big lines for queues very few things,
for, you know, for a battery or something. I mean, you can find the markets in China have more goods than what you find here in the States. I mean, anything you want, you know, from the most...
Hong Kong is right there, too.
Yeah, but, I mean, you go to, you know, any major city, you know, but, I mean, they're producing all this stuff in China. I mean, it's the factory of the world now, you know. China is, I mean, they produce an immense amount of goods.
Now, that gets back to why is all the manufacturing going there? It's because the land is cheaper there. The cost of living is cheaper because the land has been cheap for a very long time.
Well,
and there's plenty of people to work.
Yeah. Well, sure. They have, you know, there's, they have, the, what's the term in economics, you know, these... advantages.
Yeah, I can't think of it right now. But it's only based on the land price, and that'll go away because, as you said...
Well, see, what's happening now in China, and I was going to mention this, you know, because, you know, the land, you know, that the peasants and, you know, farmers, you know, have control over, you know, through this sort of lease arrangement.
99-year lease.
Well, you know, the local party authorities, many of them are basically... corrupt, you know, particularly
much
at the
like
local
ours
level.
Here.
Yeah, and they're in cahoots with these land developers.
Oh, yeah.
And the land developers...
Like the merchants,
you know, so,
downtown here!
And so what happens is the, you know, the government, you know, the local government basically uses what's equivalent to eminent domain and says, well, we're going to take your land, we're going to compensate you, you know.
Yeah, you give us some desert land over
here. We're
going to
give you, you know, whatever, the equivalent of $3,000. Of course, when the developer gets their hands on the land, the price of the land immediately jacks up
$300,000.
Yeah,
exactly.
The equivalent thereof.
That's what the county's doing here, too. They took away some guy's land that was only zoned for logging, and now they're going to zone it for putting in condominiums.
Right, so, you know, but they compensate for the value of the land, you know, prior to the
rezoning.
And then, so this is going on throughout China, and there's been all sorts of protests about this, you know, peasant insurrections, more or less. And generally speaking, you know, the central authorities or the provincial authorities send in a work group, and they come up with some compromise.
Can you get a gun in China? Are you allowed to have weapons?
Well, there again, it depends. Not in the cities, you know. but out in the countryside, you know, lots of people have guns, because they go hunting.
You know, they
still go hunting and stuff. So I saw people with guns in China, you know. Look, if you look at the polling data, I forget the name, a major international polling organization.
We don't care the name.
But no matter, you know, they do, you know, polling on attitudes, throughout the world, you know, and they use, you know, standard, you know, polling techniques. It's not like, you know, you can't do this in China. There's a lot of freedom in China for this type of activity. And actually, there's all sorts of freedoms in China that most people don't realize, you know. But the polling data shows that, you know, the Chinese, there's the highest level of satisfaction with the government, of any country in the world.
Really?
Like 85%.
Like, say, Norway or something?
85%, you know, of the people.
Well, it could be fixed, though, too, right?
No, like I say, you know, this is the...
You've been there.
I've been
recently.
Yeah.
When was the last time you were there?
I was there just a couple of years ago.
So what was your personal polling feel on it?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult for me to, you know, to gauge, you know. I just associate with the people I associate with, which is, you know, a handful of people, you know.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying about the Pew is maybe the Pew International, I think it's Pew.
It's something from Pew, outside China?
Yeah, it's the Pew International Attitudinal Poll. And they do this all over the country, you know, and they, you know, and 85% think that China's on the right track.
Well, they're also getting richer, too. So
that's the thing, you know, and what they want, you know, what the vast majority of people want in China is what the government wants, is stability. You know, they don't want to shoot the goose that laid the golden egg, you know. So,
so they're happy. You know, how about their military? They're spending a lot on military?
A fraction of what we spend, you know. And
so they're really wealthy then, because we waste a whole bunch of money on our military.
Well, yeah, it's wasteful for us, but not for the military.
Oil companies, they love it.
Not for the military industrial complex. But no, the military, the PLA, you know, is very strong. It's
What's the price of gas in China?
There's price controls. You know, they have price controls. Well, you know, the government. See, the thing about China is that it is a socialist state. I mean, the commanding heights of the economy are still controlled by the state.
They don't have a lot of oil, though. They have to import it, right?
Well, they have oil. They do have oil, but not nearly
enough. Because they have a lot of people.
So, you know, coal. They're very rich in coal resources.
Yeah, but you can't drive.
Apparently, they have a lot of natural gas. See, the problem with, you know, socialism is that it's based on a growth model. Just like capitalism is.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you want to raise living standards. So, you know, they basically want to emulate the type of, you know, life that they see in the West, you know.
Sure.
Because, hey, if they got it, why shouldn't we, you know? I mean, so it's a growth model. And there's limitations to growth. I mean, you know, so there's... you know, all sorts of problems with sustainability, with pollution, and, you know, with... they want to have energy resources. So, you know, and they're also very, you know, focused on science and technology as the answer to all societal questions.
But they've been stealing our missile guidance systems.
We stole the compass from China. So, I mean, you want to talk about...
Well, that was some time ago.
Not in the Chinese time perspective, you know. So...
You know, I remember seeing on History Channel, they were way ahead of us on the nautical
stuff. So, this whole idea of intellectual property rights,
they
have a pretty good case... make as well, you know. So I think it's a wash when it comes to that. But the thing is, since they're so focused on economic development and growth and, you know, science and technology, they're going to make the same sorts of, you know, decisions, bad decisions, that we do in our, you know, socio-political environment.
Now,
like, when I first went to China, everybody rode a bike, you know.
Right.
You know, that was the major means of transportation. So I was married to, a Chinese woman at the time. You know, I lived right in the Chinese milieu. You know, I was living in my in-laws'
apartment.
As if
they were Chinese, yeah.
Yeah. And I was working or doing research at an institute, you know, about 5 miles away.
And you rode your bike.
And I rode my bike there and back.
On a single speed bike.
And a single speed bike, you know, it's pretty flat terrain, you know, but everybody, I mean, masses of people riding their bikes to and fro. And, you know, then there would be mass transit, you know, there were trolleys and electric buses.
That's a superior than the one.
And, regular buses and mini buses and, you know, every imaginable type of mass transit. And, you know, it was virtually, you know, the buses were virtually free. And they have a wonderful, you know, underground, you know, subway system, which has been vastly expanded, you know, of late. Very modern. But it was next to nothing to take a bus, you know, like a couple of pennies, you know. And even to take, the minibus was like a dollar, you know. Chinese dollar, which is like 20 cents, you know, mm-hmm. if that, not even that. So it was, you know, and you didn't do that unless you really had to go somewhere, you know.
But I'm not likely to be taking a bus in China, so I don't really care.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, the mass transit was extremely cheap, and everybody rode their bikes. There were hardly any cars on the road.
Now they got a bunch of noisy cars,
and
everything.
Now you would think, well, that's what we're trying to, you know, establish here. Yeah, we're trying to go to a model like that, right?
Or
biking.
Appear to be going towards
that. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the, you know, progressive ideal, right? Yeah, yeah. You know, everybody rides their bike to work, you know, and there's mass transit and, you know, and all of this. And, well, that's what they had in China when I first went
there.
They
gave it up.
And they gave it up for massive traffic jams, and everybody's driving a Buick now. I mean, the last time I was in...
A Buick, really?
Oh, yeah, they love Buicks. So, last time I was in China at the museum where I was, you know...
What is it about the Buick?
It's
cheap?
Well, it's not that cheap. I mean, it's no cheaper than any other car. It just has a cachet about it. I don't know.
Not Mercedes. Or, you know.
Well, that as well. But for the mass, you know, driver, you know, it's the Buick. So, you know,
I guess they wouldn't drive Japanese cars.
I was going to this museum where I had conducted research, and my Chinese colleague, you know, had a position at, and I knew all the museum personnel. And, you know, so, basically a technician, you know, a museum technician who I had known, you know, back in the day. And he came to pick me up at the airport in his own Buick, you know. I mean, this is a museum technician driving his Buick, you know. I mean, it used to be that would be, a car from the museum, you know, it would be, you know, the museum vehicle, you know, would be driven
maybe
by
even
a driver,
limo,
you know, but, you know, the thing is, you know, now the guy's driving his own Buick, and there's, you know, and this is not like some, you know, really high, you know, bureaucratic, you know, position. He's still basically a technician,
regular guy.
Mm-hmm. But he can afford to, you know, drive a Buick. But so if he can afford to drive a Buick, you can imagine.
Almost anyone.
I mean, because, you know, the biggest auto market in the world now is China. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, a goodly segment of the Chinese population has enough money to purchase a real car, you know? I mean that's kind of amazing when you think of it.
Do they borrow from the National Bank to do this? Banking's all still
one
held.
Thing about, you know, the Chinese consumer is that they don't use credit.
They basically
buy cash on the line.
Ah,
you know, the savings rate. See, another thing, that, what our savings rate is, right?
It's dismal.
It's like it was minus something.
That's why we're going broke.
I think it's up to maybe 3-4% now. But I think that's probably an exaggeration. Yeah, we just don't save any money. You know, the average person can't save any money. Mm-hmm. In China, the savings rate is like 40%. That means people stash away 40% of their income.
Hmm.
Well, how can you stash away 40% of your income?
Where do they put it?
They put it, they put it in the bank.
What kind of interest are they getting?
Well, like 0.5%. I mean, they don't. but the thing is, inflation in China is averaging around 4%. If it goes above 4%, the government freaks out, you know?
Well, you're losing then if you're only getting 0.5%. Do they buy bonds or something?
I'm not. You know, okay, when it gets down to the specifics, I can't really say. I haven't really studied it. But all I know is that there's no question they
invest
stash
overseas?
Away. No, I don't think so. But they have a stock market in China.
Okay.
But they stash away, unbelievable percentage of their income. And that's a big problem in China.
Do they buy gold and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah. But there's
a big gold market. You don't have to worry about inflation.
Yeah. But see, the thing is, in China, the government wants the people to begin spending their money, you know, because they want to go from an export-oriented economic model to a consumption oriented economic model, you know, to develop the internal market,
right,
to maintain,
especially since this crash has really hurt them.
They want to maintain, you know, just like basically what China's doing is what we did after the war, you know, in terms of, you know, trying, we were basically, you know, developing our domestic market, you know, with sort of the social contract, you know, that was established in the 50s. You know, you had 40% of the workforce, you know, industrial workforce was unionized versus like 7% today. You know, you were negotiating these contracts that allowed for the establishment of the modern middle class.
You give money to the middle class that builds demand that gets your economy rolling.
We were creating a middle class out of the working class, you know. Mm-hmm.
We're going the other way.
Yeah, now we're going the other way. And China's developing. They're the ones that are basically implementing an economic policy to create a middle class along the lines of what we had in the 1950s.
They're going to overtake us eventually.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think what they're really doing, because now, because the Iron Rice Bowl was, you know, basically broken, you know, as they went on to the capitalist road. And like I say, the Socialist and Capital Road are still in contention. You know, it's not resolved.
They're still in contention here.
Yeah, right. So, you know, to say, oh, China's capitalist, Chinese, I mean, that's just, you know, it's that's
silly.
Taken into
for
account that it's, you know, it's a struggle, you know, as to which developmental course to take. But now what they have with the new five-year plan in China, which was initiated last year, they want to establish a more pervasive social security system. And they want, you know, they're going over to a medical insurance program like Medicare. Mm-hmm. And they're going over to...
It used to be free, didn't it?
Well, yeah, but, you know, but only for certain portions of the society, basically the urban working class who worked in state-owned enterprises.
So what did the...
And, you know, other government agencies.
What, did they send people out in the rural area to help them?
Yeah, and then they had barefoot doctors, you know, during the Cultural Revolution.
Because I heard they had decent, decent medical for a long time.
But it was, you know, rather basic, you know, which for a country of that size and, you know, degree of underdevelopment was amazing, you know, achievement. But,
yeah, compared to other countries in the same situation.
But, you know, that began to deteriorate, you know, over the last 20 years. So people, that's what, one of the reasons for the high savings rate, because people had to pay out of their own pocket for health care. So now they're trying to establish a Medicare system.
Oh, that way they want to get people to spend more money.
Right,
Now it makes sense.
Yeah, so they actually, and of course there's a big problem of food safety in China.
Why?
Because they just didn't have the infrastructure. And there's also
safety?
Because food safety.
What do you mean, bacteria or
chemicals? Well, just contamination of all sorts, you know.
What causes that?
A poor, you know, lack of regulatory control. Well, imagine if we didn't have an FDA or an EPA or any of those regulatory agencies in this country, all the foods would be adulterated and contaminated. Not that they aren't, but
sawdust in the bread.
Yeah, so you're right. You know,
standard.
So and the thing is, a lot of the small scale production in China has been privatized. You know, the government said, you know, we're not going to bother with this.
So they're putting a bunch of cellulose in food, right?
Yeah, right.
That happens
because
here. You always see it on labels.
So
what the fuck
are they putting
cardboard
in? There's all these scandals in China, constant scandals about...
So poisonous stuff they put
in? Oh, yeah, people, you know...
Can you sue over there?
Well, they don't have as, you know, a well-developed, pervasive legal system that we do, you know. So it's much more difficult. But see, the thing, what
I'm
getting...
That's horrible. You can't even trust the food there?
Well, of course.
I'm not going to China. Well, I can't eat anything.
I mean, I've never had one problem, you know, in all my time in China. You know, I've never got sick, dysentery or anything. I've just never really gotten sick. And maybe once or twice I had the runs or something, but, you know, nothing major, right? And most everybody I know is, I mean, so the instances of these food contamination scandals is, you know, given the vastness of the country and you know, it's not as, you know, as sort of dire as it might seem.
So it happens more in the rural areas.
Well, it happens, you know, all over, but it's, you know, whenever, but these instances are exposed, you know, there are big stories about it in the press. It's not like it's, you know, swept under the carpet.
Like here.
And the government is very concerned about it, so they're setting up an EPA and they're setting up an FDA.
Oh,
you know, what they're doing is, while we're, you know, dismantling the social safety net and regulatory agencies, the Chinese are looking to the U.S. model as a way to, you know, regulate, you know, the market and regulate, you know, food and drug, you know, production, you know, to, you know, develop a social safety net with unemployment compensation and, you know, so that you can have labor peace, you know, they're beginning to experiment with collective bargaining and all sorts of things that we're trying to disestablish. They're trying
to
establish.
Fascist. We're going fascist.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're going in the exact opposite direction. I mean, basically,
so they'll get stronger and we'll get weaker.
Yeah, they're basically trying to emulate what we had before 1980. When you look back on it, we really were more almost, you could almost say we were, you know, practicing the socialist road more or less.
Yes,
we were. Know, in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, the FDR, the New Deal.
Yeah, I mean, it was regulated, controlled capitalism.
That's the only kind that works.
And with a very strong public sector,
that's
the
only kind that works.
You know, so, you know, and that's what the Chinese are wanting to, you know, basically implement, you know. So, it's really very ironic, you know, that China is actually moving in the direction that led to our, you know, prosperity, you know, in the 50s and 60s, and we're going in the exact opposite direction, you know. So it's something else. You know?
That's what revolution's for.
Yeah, but you know, the getting back to the whole issue of sustainability, the problem with socialism as it's now constituted is that it is based on a growth model, you know, which is unsustainable. So, you know, like the Chinese, you know, they're all for fracking, you know, because they want to get those natural gas. They're all for building, you know, dams on the Yangtze River, you know, so they can have...
Well, dams aren't that bad, are they?
Well, I mean...
Fracking is horrible, but
fracking
dams
is, I mean, you know, but dams, I mean, you know, there are other ways of doing things, you know. You don't, I mean, dams are just not the way to go. They're trying to address the pollution problem. They're trying to go over to, you know, like green energy, you know,
they've been buying all the solar wind turbines.
Yeah. You know, every residence that are, you know, in the rural China has solar panels.
Well, sure.
You know, because the government just pumps out the solar panels. It's subsidized.
It's a lot,
you know,
cheaper than running wires all over the place.
So, you know, I mean, they're trying to do the right thing, but they're also, you got, you know, 1.3 billion people, and, you know, just imagine, you know, the arable, you know, the habitable space in China is a small fraction of the country.
Right.
You have the...
It's a very fertile
you have
area,
the
though,
Himalayas and the high plateau and the deserts, and about, you know, 1 billion of China's population lives in an area equal to the U.S. east of the Mississippi. Can you imagine stuffing a billion people into
what
the
is
US.
Their population? 3 billion or something?
Oh, 1.3.
1.3? Yeah. Oh, so the majority of it is out there.
Yeah, so 1 billion people, you know, about are, you know, in an area about the size of the eastern U.S., you know, east of the Mississippi.
It's a bunch of desert and stuff.
And the rest is desert or, you know, high mountain plateau. I mean, virtually uninhabitable regions.
Oh, you're talking a billion around the river.
Yeah, but in the, you know, the East China Plain and Sichuan Basin, you know.
Because those are very fertile because they grow rice.
Oh, yeah, they're very fertile. But I'm just saying that, the, you know, if you look at the map of China, two-thirds of China is uninhabitable.
Right.
You know? So you got, it's like, you know, just an immense number of people crammed into this very small space. So, you know, a large city in China has like 10-20 million people. I mean, and a
What's
small
New
city has, New York has 8 million.
So they're like a bunch of New York? Well, there's not that many.
Well, see, well, a city in China is more like a metropolitan area. You know,
like LA or something?
Yeah, but it's like LA and all the suburbs and everything, you know. I mean, it's like the whole metropolitan area. The metropolitan area in New York's like 12 million. You know, the city proper is 8 million.
I see.
But in China, you know, a city, you know, include, they don't divide it up into, you know, these separate, you know, districts
or boroughs,
you know, separate jurisdictions. It's all one piece. But you know, a small city in China has like 3-4 million people, you know. But another thing in China, when I first went there, about 80% of the population lived in rural areas. And in the 30 years since I first went to China, it's now 50-50.
Okay.
And within another 20 years...
Because our jobs are near manufacturing.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, so they want people to move into these new cities. People talk about these ghost cities in China.
And it's usually like the, you know, that, the yeah. kids are moving in, the parents stay back in the farm.
Yeah, like well, the migrant farm, you know, the migrant workers, sorry, the migrant workers in China. You know, and that's what we always hear about, you know, in the sweatshops and how, yeah. you know, slave labor and
they
all
like
this.
They like it, though. I mean, it's,
well,
it's what, a
mostly
deal than they were
getting young women.
Yeah.
Young women, some of them even 16, 17, 18 years old, you know, from the countryside. They have, you know, maybe a grade school education, maybe junior high, you know, year of high school equivalent, and then they go. I mean, this is the adventure of their lifetime. You know, they're just unbelievably excited to get off the farm and go into the city, and you know, and
you get to see, meet a lot of people.
It's a big adventure, yeah. you know. Yeah. And they start out in these real hell holes, you know. But they don't stay there, you know. They have connections. They have other family members who mm-hmm. went before them, and they sort of work their way up the ladder. So you know, within a year or two, they're you know they've maybe gone through two or three jobs. I mean, there's no problem finding work in China, hmm. you know.
I like here.
Yeah. So and eventually, a lot of these people, you know, they kind of you know some of them strike it rich. You know, I've met these peasant millionaires in China. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of Horatio Alger stories. There's much more social mobility in China than here.
Wow.
And it's a you know it's really a crazy place. I mean, it's. And the cultural scene, you know, is really vibrant, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, there's all sorts of hip-hop
so they must
bands
be very, very optimistic.
It's a crazy, crazy place, you know, just unbelievable. You know, the picture that's painted of China in the Western press is just so full of stereotypes
propaganda.
And propaganda. It's, I mean, people have no idea what the real China's like. It's... and of course, you know, like I say, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Now you've been 2 years. What are the land values in the city like? Like, what's rent for?
Oh well,
one
you
bedroom?
Know, if you want a nice apartment, it's as pricey.
Comparable to one here.
Yeah, it's as pricey as anywhere else in the world. You know, and it's you know, living costs in Beijing for someone who wants to live that style of life is going to be comparable to New York or anywhere
here?
Else.
Same as here? Same size
oh,
room?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Same size apartment, same price?
Pretty much.
And their salaries are same as
well,
here?
Well, some people can afford it, you know.
But I mean, is it like a regular salary?
But no, well, you know, like I say, you know, there are many, many people who can afford you know, that type of housing, but many who can't, you know. I mean, so now the government's also building
well, I mean,
a lot of...
maybe people from here might want to move there, you know, to
well,
get a job.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, you know, you really have to know the language, you know. But they're building a lot of subsidized housing in China as well for, you know, the lower echelons, you know, of society. You know, people who just haven't kept pace.
Where do they build those? In the cities?
In the cities, yeah. Okay. I mean, you go to China and it looks like, you know... you know, a European city after World War II, you know, the cranes are everywhere. Yeah. Still, I mean, ever since I went to China, you know, the cityscape has always been full of, you know, these cranes, you know, just building, 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 constant building.
Gosh, it sounds so much better than here.
Well, there's, like I say, I mean, there's the upside and there's the downside. I mean, you, one thing that's really interesting, you know, I've been to areas of China that look like they were hit by an atom bomb, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Debris all over the place, you know, the roads are just all torn up and there's litter lining the roads for miles on end. It looks like a you know, like you're living in a, you know, in a trash, you know mm-hmm. yard, a trash heap. But then you go back 2 or 3 years later and it's all cleaned up, and you know, they built, you know, a new city and, you know, new city center and all sorts of... So, I mean, it's... You just can't tell from 1 year to the next what you're going to see. You know, you can see some of the most polluted, most, you know, horrible type of situations. But then, you know, they can mobilize their forces. And
they got
know,
the people.
They got the people, they got the money, they got, you know, the, mm-hmm. the know-how. They know what to do to clean things up, you know. It's pretty amazing.
And they got the money now, too. I mean,
oh, they got, yeah.
they're getting all our money.
Yeah, they got like a couple of trillion bucks in foreign exchange, you know.
Every year or something?
Yeah, well, you know, Right now, you know, and another myth is that, you know, a balance of trade in China. Now, we have a deficit.
Right.
You know, China as a whole is basically running pretty even. And they don't have a vast, massive balance of trade excess. You know, there's many countries where they have a...
They're importing,
you know.
But not here.
They're importing from Japan. They're importing from Germany. Germany and Japan do not have a deficit in trade with China.
Is that because they have tariffs against them or something?
No. I mean, hey, and this whole business about tariffs is a bunch of bull, because, you know, they're part of the, you know, the World Trade Organization, right. And, you know, if
so
there
it's
are
just that tariffs, we don't produce anything of any value to them. Is that it?
Basically, you know, we've offshored all our production, you know, whereas Germany and Japan have not, you know. And Germany and Japan have much more vibrant labor movements than we do, and they have a social contract, which is still basically intact. Now, that's beginning to get tattered in other European social democracies with, you know, their debt crisis, so-called.
Greece. They're kicking Greece out.
Yeah, but this debt crisis is another story. That's a total, you know, that's a means by for the 1% in Europe to try to dismantle the social democracy that's been created, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a totally bogus situation.
Well, just stiff them. You know, like Iceland did.
Yeah.
They're doing fine.
Argentina.
Yeah, just stuff the fucking bankers.
That's what the Greeks should do, you know,
Yeah, fuck you. We're not
paying
back.
I mean, and the thing, like in Argentina, they had a couple of years of real depression, but now they're going, you know, full.
Because you can't, that's the only way to get out from underneath that crap, you know.
So.
Jubilee.
Yeah. So anyway, China is a lot different than most people, you know, want to believe, you know, and it's a very dynamic situation. Now, I just have to emphasize, you know, both socialism and capitalism, as far as I'm concerned now, are unsustainable because they're based on industrial growth economy, and we have to get away from this idea that we have to constantly grow, because, you know, I mean, obviously,
to stop the Roman Empire,
there's a limit, you know, to growth. So what happens when you reach that limit, you know? Well, you know, maybe there's a technological fix. You know, you just, the rule with computers, you or computer wizards here.
Moore's Law.
You know, every 16 months or, the capacity doubles or whatever.
Yeah.
And there is, you know, there's amazing new technologies, and the Chinese are now putting more money into research and development.
Then they're really going to get ahead of this.
I mean, so they're into biotech, all these things. And one very interesting thing.
We're eating our seed corn.
They are very much against GMO.
I wish we were.
But there are forces, of course, that want to see it, but at the grassroots level. Now, I actually have a blog where I was translating Chinese, because I speak and translate Chinese, you know, so I was translating these articles from the Maoist websites, which have now been shut down because of this, you know, political turmoil in China. But there were these a whole slew of these left-wing Maoist websites, Utopia, Mao flag, and all of this. They had all these articles highly critical of the policies being implemented by the government. And they one thing that they were really against were GMOs, because they said, you know, this was a means for the West to genetic, you know, to practice genocide against the Chinese people. And they would have what they called reverse propaganda teams. Of youth.
Who would?
Groups affiliated with these websites. I'm sure, you know, the Communist Party people involved, because these websites could not be, you know, sanctioned unless there were people in the party who supported them, right? I mean, but there would be these contingents of young people. They were called reverse propaganda teams, and they would set up these big billboards in the parks, you know, the public parks, you know, outlining the dangers of GMO foods. And, you know, Greenpeace has a big presence in China, sanctioned by the, you know, the government. So, I mean, people just have no idea, you know, that there is a level of discourse in China, you know, on their websites that are, you know, basically, you know, extolling the Cultural Revolution and Mao Zedong thought, and then there are other websites that are preaching, you know, neoliberal, you know, economic ideas about privatization.
Is there any anarchists in China?
I'm sure there are. I've never come across any anarchist websites in China. That might be a little bit, you know, beyond the pale, you know, but...
You don't see Circle A's in Red Square?
No, not quite. You know, anarchism, to my knowledge, never really caught on in China. I think, you know, Chinese, you know, culture is such that... You know, anarchism just kind of, you know, cuts against the grain, so to speak, you know.
They're inclusive.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, China's all about, you know, structure, you know. I mean, it's very, you talk about levels. Hierarchy.
Oh, yeah, they believe
I mean, that's where hierarchy was invented in China, you know. What are you going to do?
I see, that's it.
So, I mean, anarchism, you know, there might be some grassroots anarchists in China. I'm sure there are. But like I say, they don't make a big splash, you know.
I see. But. Well, we don't want this to get too long or becomes unwieldy to post and stuff. This has been Free the Land on May 29th.
Okay, thanks
with
for
Dennis
having
Etley.
Me. Mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure. Appreciate it.
And, can you tell that he's a... Profession. Do you want to know?
We mentioned that. Yeah, I teach not only Cabrillo but a number of other community colleges. I'm sort of an itinerant Darwinist, you know.
So you have a Darwin holiday every year.
The Secular Humanists of Santa Cruz County, our major event every year in February is our annual Darwin Day event.
What day is that?
Well, right around Darwin's birthday, which is like the same, which is Lincoln's birthday, February, what is it, 12th?
Yeah. Do you have a monkey mascot?
I do have, not on now, but I do.
In February.
Yeah, in February.
He lead the parade.
Yeah,
she...
right. So, we had the Harrisons for our last Darwin Day. They're a couple, Professor Emeritus from UC San Diego, who are now here in the Santa Cruz area. They are eco-artists, and they talked about... the work they've done to promote ecological awareness through various design projects that they've been involved with. So we hope to have another powerhouse event come February.
Anything coming up this summer?
Well, the only other thing, not during the summer so much.
What are you, atheists just come out in the winter?
In the fall, I'm also
Christians got Christmas, Easter, they
yeah,
got a bunch
well, no,
of them.
Yeah, well,
they're
a whole slew of secular holidays, you know, but mostly they're the same ones that, you know, other progressives, you know, sort of International Women's Day and, you know, all the lefty holidays.
The Death
consider,
of God Day, do you have
yeah,
one of those?
Right. But you know, what we have in the fall, since I'm also involved with the Secular Student Alliance at Cabrillo, you know, it's basically a secular humanist group on campus, and every fall we had our first annual Flying Spaghetti Monster Pastafarian Pirate Dinner, which is a celebration of humanist ideals. On campus, we had a very large turnout, about 80 people, and we see it as a, you know, a means to do social, you know, service type outreach. So we collected cell phones for the women's center, Cedar Street Women's Center.
You don't do any Down with God posters or anything?
Well, we don't want to antagonize. Well, we did do a very good we were involved along with the Atheists of Santa Cruz County, another group, you know, secular
humanists.
Are
they like the
little,
radical side?
Yeah.
You're like the moderate.
Right. Okay. We're more sort of even tempered, but we did get the menorah to come down, you know, from in front of the library. You know, there was a menorah, you know, that had been erected by some... Shabbat by the Sea, you know, this Hasidic...
I'm assuming it wasn't a Catholic.
No, it was a Jewish menorah, you know, candelabra. And they put it up, you know, because, you know, they wanted to, you know, there's Christmas tree lights and all that.
Everywhere else.
And, but they put it up on a public space, and so we challenged that. Basically, there was a city rule that, you know, in order to put something of that sort up, you had to have like $1 million insurance policy and have standing guards, you know, 24/7. But, you know, because we wanted to put up, Reason's greeting banner, you know.
Yeah.
We march in the holiday parade with our Reason's greetings
banner.
Yeah, Reason's.
Like instead. Reason, being reasonable?
Yeah, being rational. Rational thought, you know. We always get a big round of applause. But we wanted to put that up in opposition to these other religiously, you know, themed, you know, sort of decorations. But the city said, no, we had to have $1 million insurance policy and 24/7 guards. So then we demanded to know if the menorah had that. They didn't. So they basically had to take the menorah down.
And I think Santa Cruz itself doesn't get insurance. They self-insure.
Yeah. So, and then another thing that we did was, on campus, the Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, had a table in the cafeteria, and they had it at, like, every day, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they were passing out literature, this is ridiculous. Well, you know, this is a public institution. What about separation of church and state? Because the rules are that, organization like that, off-campus organization, has to sign a contract, and they can only be there, like, 3 days a month, and they have to register everything that they, you know, pass out. And they weren't doing any of this. So we demanded to see, you know, the contract, and they basically, there wasn't any contract. It was just a, you know, gentleman's
just started
agreement.
Showing up, huh?
Yeah, and the basically the dean of students said, okay, do what you want to do. So then we demanded that they adhere to the contract, and the guy said, okay, we'll do that. You know, yeah, you're right. They should sign the contract like everybody else. So they went about going through the motions, but it's still there. So then what's going on? Oh, well, they got a dispensation. You know, they just said, you know, they were basically absolved of, you know, of these clauses. You know, they got approval, you know. So then we sort of started, you know, making a fuss, and you know, and eventually they're gone. They're no longer there. So
I guess they don't come to your house anymore either. Now,
what's that?
I'll bet they don't come to your house anymore for doing that.
They don't come knocking on the door. But who knows? But no, they were all like, you know, kind of more older set. You know, so I'm not too worried. But you know, you don't see Jehovah's Witnesses, younger than a certain age. You know. At least
it's,
I don't.
It's the Mormons that they send the young ones.
Yeah,
they only
the
do
Mormons,
it for a
little
bit.
And
you don't
know,
see too many Mormons.
And then they have, you know, Campus Crusade for Christ. And, but oh, Jesus Christ, you know, what can I say?
So here you go, using
Buddha,
a Roman name for someone you don't believe in.
Well, we have to maybe have another discussion about.
I object to you. Do you using a name of a religious icon like that, and you a secular humanist. Isn't that hypocrisy?
it's just a figure of speech, as they say.
Okay.
Yeah.
What would Confucius say?
Exactly. What
swear
would,
to Buddha. Now, what about Buddhism? That doesn't require.
Well, Buddha, you know, Buddhism in and of itself is not a religion; it's a philosophy.
Right. There's no God in Buddha.
Yeah, Buddhism. I mean, now there's popular Buddhism, you know, sort of the big vehicle, Mahayana Buddhism, and there they have all the bodhisattvas, and you know, and this and the that. And, you know, it's become a folk religion, you know, in much of Asia, you know.
Well,
so they
bodhisattva just means you're giving up.
Yeah, but I mean, but they have, you know, pray to the, you know, various incarnations of the Buddha and you know,
it's
there's the arhats and the bodhisattvas and, you know, I mean, so it's like a religion. Yeah, it is a religion. It's a folk religion.
It is a religion.
Yeah.
So
but I mean, but Buddhism per se, you know,
is
a philosophy, but it's been transmogrified into a religion. Religion, you know,
so what if they were handing out literature in the cafeteria at school?
Well, if they adhere to the, you know, the established procedures, we don't have any problem with that. You know, just when they contravene those rules and regs that have been established for everybody, why should they have a special dispensation? You know, so against that.
Have you always been an atheist?
I was born free.
No. I had to assert mine.
Sorry to step on your name there, but that's sort of, you know, my family is secular Jews, you know, so I was born, you know, without religion. I remember when I was 7 years old and I was talking to my young girlfriend at the time. We were both dressed in cowboy outfits, and
you had a girlfriend at seven?
Well, she was just a neighbor girl. Okay. We were very friendly. It was, you know, it wasn't what you think. You know?
I was just making a joke. That's all.
But anyway, I was telling her about, you know, how I was an atheist, you know, and didn't believe in God. I was very proud of it. I said, I didn't see much of her afterwards.
She wouldn't join your secular
school. I don't know, maybe the parents were
mulling about... Did you start one in school
at
that? When did you first start doing secular forming, groups?
Well, you know, when I got here to Santa Cruz a few years back, and
I mean,
I was looking for like-minded people.
Just being an
see, the thing is, since I'm an...
That's organizing against God.
Right, but, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist, you know, human paleontologist, you know, and so, you know, and an atheist, so I'm thinking, you know, trying to find a group of like-minded people, and there wasn't any such group in town, so I decided to organize one. Yeah. And, but there's a big group in Palo Alto, you know.
That's popular. A lot of people at the Penny U are secular humanists.
Yeah. Well, Penny U, I mean, I attend Penny U, you know, pretty regularly, and, yeah.
This is Mondays at 5 at Red
Church. Basically, you know, right. But, I mean, you know, the basic, it's basically, more theistically oriented.
Well,
you know.
Paul Lee is a
theologian, you know, so he's...
There's always the debate between the atheist there and Paul. And
but, I mean, he sees it all metaphorically. He's not a literalist.
He was going out of the fundamental Christians. They're just crazy. And the secular humanists go, we see you as crazy.
But see, now, I'm very eclectic. I'm a big fan of Teilhard de Chardin. If you are familiar.
Dropping names, are you?
Well, that's not a name dropper. You know, that's, I mean, he's one of the, you know.
I forget what he is, but I forget.
Yeah, he's a great, you know, philosopher.
Sounds French.
Yes, he was. But, yeah, so, I mean, he's the founder of the whole, you know, cosmic consciousness idea, you know.
That the whole universe is aware.
Yeah, that we're moving towards the Omega point and all of that. You know, sort of, he's the fount of wisdom for the New Age movement. I mean, all this business about, you know, the Mayan calendar in 2012 and the Great Shift and all of that. I mean, it's rooted in the, you know, Teilhard's, you know, philosophy. They don't know it is, you know,
but
it is.
It's also in the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, it's very derivative. But, you know, the vocabulary and, you know, the basic, you know, philosophical orientation comes primarily from...
Well, you said you're a fan of them.
Yeah, I mean... because
so you think the universe is conscious?
No. Well, you know, Teilhard's idea is that we're, you know, the humans, you know, since we do have this sentience, we're a conduit between a pre-conscious and a fully conscious universe. You know, so we're moving in that direction. What the ultimate, you know, conscious entity will be is, you know, unknown.
But we're separate entities.
But we're the conduit through which cosmic consciousness will manifest itself.
Oh, it's how God's opening its eyes.
Well, basically, we become God as we, you know, strive
become
towards the Omega
conscious,
point and become cosmically conscious. You know, so the whole cosmos becomes a single conscious entity, and, you know, that's the Godhead. But that's far in the future.
So we're
striving towards the Godhead.
See, I don't necessarily believe in time myself.
That's a figment. I mean...
really, we're still in the singularity. You can't leave a singularity.
Well, see, the question I have, do you really know what happened yesterday?
Yeah, we could be going backwards in time and you just forget
it. I mean, particularly if you believe in the multiverse.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And then, you know,
we really
don't know what universe you happen to be in and in any given time, so do you really know what happened yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if the multi-universe...
You're branching off.
Because the multi-universe is still... part of a single, you know...
It's just the fifth dimension.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot more, according to string theory.
Yeah, well,
There's probably
do you have some Fifth Dimension to play? Or
okay.
No music, I already told her. We don't want sound exchange on our ass here.
I can hunt for it.
That's also in the Kabbalah. You said you're Jewish.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but the vocabulary of the New
See, now
age
you scratch an atheist, and here he is, you know, right in the, you know, deistic.
Well,
that's deistic.
Know, no, I don't believe,
You don't believe it's some anthropomorphic dude walking around ordering the universe.
You know, when you get down to, you know, origins, you know, that's a whole nother issue, you know. I mean...
Our Founder, who art in heaven, singularity be thy name.
Oh, I wish I had it with me. I have a Pastafarian Lord's Prayer, you know.
The beginning of the universe was a singularity.
Yeah.
A point of no dimensions, no time, no space. You can't get out of that, you know.
Well,
it's like it's the center of black holes,
but, you know,
too.
The whole question of, is the universe expanding or resolving? if the universe is still a singularity.
Right. You can't escape that, right?
Did the universe expand? How can the universe expand? You know,
time and space appeared inside the singularity somehow.
So basically, what's happening is that at the original point of singularity,
the big suck.
What you had was a monad. A monad, right? So what happens to that? This is not a monad that we're sitting in.
Or it doesn't appear to
so
be.
So what happens is that monad begins to resolve itself into the multiplicity of, of reality that we see. So
a zero dimension somehow
you're basically
turns into a multi-dimension.
Seeing is, we're becoming pixelated.
I saw something on one of the, I think it's through the wormhole, somebody had a theory that it's all just one line. It's really, really crinkly.
Yeah, well, ultimate reality is,
the singularity is a point.
Yeah.
A point.
So, I mean,
so somehow you get to a point, to a line, to a plane, to a sphere, to a fourth dimensional, to a fifth dimensional multiverse.
So there's,
on.
Yeah, there's all sorts of questions of that sort, But, who knows?
It could all be random chance. It doesn't really require.
It could all. Yeah, we have no idea, really. I mean,
now you're an agnostic.
No, we have no idea what reality. I mean, reality is, far beyond what we can sense.
We sense something, but we don't even know if that's real.
There's an article about whales having some new sensory, organ in their jaws.
Really?
For feeding, so that they can sense
electricity.
They feed on krill. These are baleen whales, and in order to feed on krill, they have to go through all these contortions. It would be impossible, except if it was extremely well coordinated. The coordination is very, very finely tuned, and they have evolved entirely unique sensory organ to coordinate, the process of ingesting and swallowing krill.
I heard sharks, they'll go for electricity.
Yeah, sharks have an electromagnetic sense, and monarch butterflies, have a GPS unit in their brains.
We probably have it, too. It's probably some magnetic.
Yeah, I mean, birds have it,
and
birds,
some people like the Taoist.
Birds can see into the ultraviolet, so they see colors that we can't even perceive. Yeah. So who's to say that what we perceive as reality is?
And how, when you're dreaming, you think it's happening. You can't tell the difference.
Right.
Sometimes you can, but same thing here. Sometimes that's the Buddhist. Well, you got enlightened, and this isn't real.
So I mean, the thing is, what we perceive as reality is just a tiny. I mean, how much of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can perceive, visually. I mean, it's just a tiny, tiny little fraction. So all that rest of that reality, we can perceive with the aid of instruments and technology. So we can put telescopes that can view the universe in the ultraviolet and infrared and the micro.
And that's still just the created universe.
But
that comes out of
that's
the quantum
what we
fluctuation.
Still can perceive, right? I mean, there could be all sorts of aspects of the universe, and you know, that we cannot perceive, that we have no, we can't fathom. I mean, already there's dark matter, dark energy. We have hardly any idea what
quantum vacuum.
Yeah. So I mean, there could be all sorts of
that sort of telepathy and
aspects of
How do you feel about telepathy?
Like I say, we know so little about the world that we live in that I'm not going to preclude, all sorts of phenomena that I can't perceive. So I'm agnostic when it comes to that.
Yeah. So you're mostly just opposed to an anthropomorphic idea of God, because what you're talking to me is very similar.
Well, the term God is so laden with meanings that I don't see it as a useful, a metaphor or a figure of speech. I just prefer not to use it because it doesn't really describe what I have in mind. I mean, a God generally. If you don't see a God as a personal God that can intervene in human affairs and has sort of a will and some objective,
I see those as godless.
Right. So I mean, that's my conception of God. Now, if you want to talk about God as some unifying, eternal
ground of
force.
Being,
well, why call that God? I mean, that's just what it is, some sort of force, some unifying principle.
Infinity.
Whatever you want to call it. I mean, but that's not the common conception of God, so why use the term? It just confounds one's thinking.
Yeah, the anthropomorphic version is limited, because it has to have a personality, then, if it's a personal
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's just, superfluous.
To me, that's just possibly like a higher... There might be electromagnetic beings like that with certain powers.
We have no idea, I mean, it doesn't make sense to even, dwell on any of that, because it's all pure speculation. You can come up with any
scenario. I like to speculate.
Oh, it's fun, but I mean, it doesn't have any direct relevance to my life,
See, you just... As communist atheists, you find out they're actually
much
more complicated.
I think it was Mao who said he was looking forward to meeting up with Marx after he was gone from this earth.
This may mean you've been thrown out as the chairman of the secular humanists.
No, that's okay. I think that
all right, well, we definitely got to end this.
Yeah.
Okay, this has been Free the Land, May 29th, 2012.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, you need to put shows on it.
Influence on the whole election and how, I don't know. I didn't.